Hi, everyone. This is the Broke Girl Society podcast. I'm your host, Christina. Thank you so much for listening in. Today's episode is going to be brought to you by our sponsors, the Better Institute, where people go to get better. You can find them at betterinstitute.com. And our new sponsor, Birch's Health, an online gambling addiction therapy. You can do it all online. You can find them at birchshealth.com. Therapy is an amazing tool to add to your toolbox in recovery. It's a great way to stop that bleeding and start that healing. So please check them out. All right, guys, we are back with Dr. Evelyn Higgins, who is the CEO of Wired for Addiction, and she is bringing some science to our conversation today. Dr. Higgins has spent the better part of 30 years in the mental health field, and she's done a lot of research and development to help us understand the biochemical pathways of addiction, and she's going to share some of that work with us today. She also has a very personal connection, you know, helping loved ones who have struggled with addiction. And so I hope you really enjoy this conversation. If you want to reach out to Dr. Higgins, you can send an email to staff@wiredforaddiction.com or just go to their website, wiredforaddiction.com, and find out all the information on the work that she's been doing. There's a lot of science behind it, and it's very, very fascinating. So here we go. Hi, Evelyn.
Hey, Christina. Thank you for having me. Great kind of tee up to this conversation is the why. Because most people don't even understand how they arrived to that problem point, right? Awesome. And the way it works is we're not healthy one day and sick the next. It's all the living that we do in between that brings us to either end of that spectrum. So it's not, we're not healthy one day and addicted the next. It's all the living in between that gets us to either end of that spectrum. And addiction really evolves out of one, two, or three of these things: a mental health condition undiagnosed, a mental health condition diagnosed, but you're being treated improperly, so improperly diagnosed, a trauma, one, two, or all three of those. And it starts as self-medicating. And we don't even know why we're doing it. We just know, whoa, I feel good when I do this. So often underlying is anxiety, depression, ADD, ADHD, OCD. But there's always that underlying factor that brings us to be reaching outside of ourselves to find something to make us feel good. And when we first do it, it feels really good. And it works until it doesn't work. Then it becomes the problem. But it's getting people to understand how that even all unfolds to get there. You just don't wake up one day and say, hey, I am a gambler and I just lost everything. Doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly connect with that because that was very much my story. You know, I started gambling around 28 and found recovery around 42. So in that lifespan, you know, I didn't start out as a problem gambler at 28. Right. My problem gambling became a problem probably around 35. And it's interesting that you say it's all the living in between, because what I experienced in between 28 and 35 was a lot of traumatic, abusive relationship. Yeah. And, you know, it became my way of coping with that because I didn't know how to voice my issues. I didn't know how to stand up for myself. And it was just easier to not talk about it and to not think about it. And gambling became my way of not doing those things.
Right.
So I really connected with how you said that. And I think a lot of women that reach out to me, you know, they're just trying to understand this. Like, how did this happen to me? Sure. And you talk a lot about kind of the behind the scenes of that, you know, whether it's just like you said, whether it's a mental health condition or you talk about genetics, right?
Absolutely.
And how that plays a part in addiction. And I think a lot of people would be interested to hear that, especially if they come from a family full of addiction.
Sure. And it doesn't have to be that they were all gamblers. You know, typically that's not what we see. We arrive at whatever makes us feel good in our addiction at whatever point we are in our life. You know, you are going through traumatic experiences relationship-wise and found gambling, and that was it. Had you found something else, that might have been it. But that at that point in time, that entered your world, and that gave you that physiological change that you needed.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, and it felt good.
Yeah.
You know, so what we do is what we look at 85 different biomarkers. So we have actual objective information. There are physiological changes within someone that have mental health condition, that have addiction. So we identify those. You know, so often first the stigma that surrounds all this is people want to say, no, that doesn't exist anymore. It does, right? It sure does.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you even look at how it's treated. You know, first off, hats off to you for having this podcast because it's not discussed. You know, and it's kind of like, well, you got yourself there. You had enough money to go gamble. You know, you can get yourself out of this. Instead of looking at it like this is a condition, it's a disease that we need to treat like any other disease. You know, if somebody had diabetes, we wouldn't say, hey, why is so weak? Just don't eat that. But when it comes to addiction, we really label that person and tell them that they're weak and they're the problem. So we never use technology to advance this part of healthcare. And that's what we did in our company, Wired for Addiction and Wired Biohealth. We looked at that technology that's not now available today to say, we've got to actually measure with labs and have objective information where this person's at, because if we don't get them to the other end of this, they are going to stay in that addiction. Because that's their survival mechanism at this point. So we look at things called neurotransmitters or brain chemicals, where we measure someone's serotonin, their dopamine, their epinephrine, their norepinephrine, their phenylethylamine, the list goes on and on. And then we look at hormones, from stress hormones to sex hormones, how those interact. And then the remaining are what are called, science word here, genetic single nucleotide polymorphisms. All that means is it's your genetic coding and that there is an error in that coding. That error creates things that we call aberrant behavior. That's things like risk-taking, impulse control, anxiety, depression, addiction. So we look at all of those biochemical pathways and say, where are you less than optimal? And we support those pathways instead of saying, well, you know what? You're a problem gambler. Okay, you know, now what do? Right? You know you are, because your life is already unmanageable, or else it wouldn't even be, you wouldn't be listening, your listeners wouldn't be listening to your podcast, right? They're looking for help. So that's exactly what we do. We identify, we isolate, we measure. None of us, you know, here's the part, Christine, there's more than 7.5 billion people in the world, yet we treat everybody exactly the same way when it comes to, you know, here's what's going to help you. They all have their unique DNA. No one has the same. So unless we identify where that individual is at, we're going to be guessing. You know, and someone is going to be diagnosed based on vocabulary words. What if they even tell the truth about what's going on? You know, they right. may think that, say, anxiety is embarrassing. So I'm not going to say I'm an anxious person. I'm going to say something different. You know, and you wind up with a different prescription. It doesn't right. make sense to be here where we are in 2023, still practicing like it's a, you know, 1950. It doesn't make sense. So that's what we do, right? And people often ask, like, well, can you identify this addiction versus that? It doesn't work that way. There are genes that set us up for this. And you may not see it in your other family members, because it wasn't expressed in them. It was still there in their DNA, but it wasn't expressed. And it's often like when people say, you know, I never saw this behavior in my daughter till she was 21. From 1 to 20, nothing. Well, that DNA was always the same. However, the new stressors in her life are what created the expression of what was in her DNA. And that's called epigenetics. That, to me, that's the most fascinating part of what's happening in science today, to know that the expression of our DNA can change. There is such power in that, because if we could turn those genes on, we can also turn them off.
That is absolutely amazing to think about because, you know, when you look at a lot of the data that comes out on when gambling starts for, especially in women, this is what it looks like. And it, you know, it's kind of around the menopausal, the fasting, you know, kind of when life situations change, divorce, that was very much for me. And then, so it's really interesting to kind of see the science behind it saying there is an actual reason why. And I do want to express to those listeners who, might be trying to still figure out a reason why, like, this is, you know, this is absolutely fascinating, but to still like explore, you know, like therapy and things like that as Like, I want to just clarify for somebody listening, like, oh, I can just take a medicine and, you know, pill and fix this. That's not the case. But what's so fascinating is to really understand ways to like really advocate for what's going on with us, to really start and encourage having those conversations and to know that there are, you know, all these external factors that we can look at and heal and work on and get us to a better place for somebody listening that's just really just overwhelmed by everything.
We look at the physiology component of it, right? What makes an addiction such a complex disease is that it's a biopsychosocial disease. So that biological piece, until now, it's just been, well, you need to sleep 7 to 8 hours, good quality sleep. Make sure you exercise. Make sure you're eating good, dense nutrition in your food. You know, it was kind of the common sense of lifestyle, and your unique physiology with those genetic weaknesses was never addressed. So it's the biological piece and the psychosocial. So you've got to do that talk therapy. You've got to. It's all part of it because it is so complex. There are so many layers to it. You've got to do all the parts because just one alone, you're lessening the chances of getting to where you want to go.
Right. And especially when you talk about that life piece, you know, it's really great to have that support on all sides and look for that. But I'm really hopeful for the future of gambling harm recovery, for the science and the work that you're doing to help us better understand this, because that just means the more work that we're doing to understand this, the more help we're able to offer. And especially when it comes to gambling harm, it's not something that a lot of people are involved in, or addiction harm in general, but it's not something, you know, there's no federal funding for resources or research for gambling harm. It's, you know, spread out through the whole mental health industry, but it's great to know that there is other ways that we can find the research and stuff that we need. And there are a lot of great people out there trying to help us navigate all the different ways that we can heal and advocate for ourselves. And when we talk about the stigma piece, you know, where it's still really hard to have conversations openly with our doctors and with people who don't understand addiction, one, and especially don't understand a gambling addiction because they think, oh, well, that's a financial problem. That's not a mental health problem. You know, it just adds to how this addiction stays so silent. And so, you know, just to have these encouraging conversations, to help break the stigma of that, especially for women as the primary caregivers of the home. In most cases, you know, they're the primary caregivers. They're also probably working full time. They're shuffling kids around. They're doing all this stuff and they don't necessarily take the time for themselves to research and get help and try and stay informed and try to really just understand the whole package of it. So anything that we can do to make those things easier for women to find help, to feel safe getting help, I'm always super grateful for.
Absolutely. And you mentioned, you know, the harm reduction funding from the government. To sit around and wait for that to happen, you know, you're going to be in a much worse place than you already are now, because that's all smoke and mirrors. That's, you know, let's make this look good. Let's make that look good. And a lot of it is just the education. Hey, don't do this. Well, if it were that easy, nobody would have a problem, because nobody wants to lose their family, their home, their friends, their job. You know, you don't wake up one day and say, hey, great idea, let me do this. It's not how it works. You know, so we're really in the forefront of looking at the science of this acknowledging that it is a disease process, a condition that needs to be treated as such, and really get out there. And, you know, the work that you do is huge, because even like you said, like, so gambling itself doesn't get the attention it needs. And then you bring the woman piece into it. It's like, no, women don't do that, really. And it's easier and easier and easier. And the numbers are growing exponentially because of what's available online. People are finding that place to, in air quotes, feel good by raising their dopamine, by having their serotonin where it should be, by going online and having a relationship with the computer.
That's what I always say. I always tell people when they're trying to understand their relationship with gambling, I'm like, it's like that toxic ex, you know, that just keeps pulling you back in and keeps taking and taking and taking and never giving, giving, giving. And that's exactly how I identify it for me. It was like, it was that really toxic ex, you know, that just caused more harm than good. And, you know, and I'm not somebody that talks about like, controlled gambling or anything like that. Just because of the level of harm that I've experienced myself and that I see others experience. So for me, it's like, I know that I can never gamble again. It would be like, you know, just lighting my world on fire if I even did one bet, just because it's not something I can shut off. It's just, you know, one of those things. But I'm curious to like how somebody who's trying to explore kind of where they're at with their gambling, whether like they're not maybe necessarily seeing the financial harm yet, but they are experiencing maybe harm in their relationships and things like that. How do you help somebody identify kind of that mental shift or that shift of like, this is a problem, and, you know, kind of that beginning thing where it kind of tipples over, you know?
Well, you know, from like taking the, what I call the honesty inventory and really being honest with yourself, it's like, do I need to be going outside of myself all the time to feel balance within me? And if that answer is yes, do lap panel, right? And because otherwise we're just guessing. And someone may say like, you know, I feel like I just don't have motivation to get off the couch. Well, it's never, when we're just talking about the neurotransmitter aspect of these, it's never just one, because the body is always trying to stay in what we call homeostasis or balance. So it's going to borrow from the others to keep things going. And by the time it's now screaming its head at you saying, hey, do something, we've got a lot going on there. So, you know, with inside yourself, when you're always like, I'm looking for something else, I'm looking for something else, or just that impulse feels good, or that risk feels good, you've got to take a look at what's going on in your physiology. It's just like, you know, you go through yearly to your PCP and you do blood work, right? How many red blood cells, how many white blood cells? This is the same thing. You know, and hopefully we'll get to that one day when this is part of, here's your wellness package. Let's see what your mental health is. We're looking at today, the post-COVID numbers that came out recently in the Kaiser study, at 53% of the population suffering with anxiety and depression. That's acknowledged.
Yeah.
But if you're out in public, you know that the number is greater, because people are really unkind. You know, people are not acting their best self out there today. We all know that, right? So those numbers are staggering. So people are going to be going outside of themselves to try to bring them that balance that they're after, not even knowing what they're doing.
Right. Yeah. And I always, when I hear like statistics and numbers and things like that, I'm always questionable on them too, because, you know, it's like, there's so much people aren't saying. So it's like, if they're basing on just the people that are saying something, or, you know, willing to talk about it, like, can you imagine
we're talking better than 75-80%. If you're going to the doctor saying, doc, I'm anxious, I need something, it's much greater. Pre-COVID, it was at the 25%. And we know that it was more like 40-50, you know, now acknowledging 53% is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. And opportunities are everywhere. Let's face it. You know, it's you don't even have to walk outside of your house, right? You have exactly what you need there. If you choose to go outside, anything you want is available.
Yep. Yeah, and that's the part where there's a movement called trying to get people to talk to their PCPs about their addiction, right? Or their gambling, or even like on the intake paperwork. I know a lot of states are implementing it, you know, on the intake paperwork on, do you have a problem with this, this, or this? You know, they ask alcohol all the time. They're like, how many drinks do you think you'll do a week?
Right.
But there's never anything about anything else, right? It's just alcohol.
Right.
And then substances, right? They take your substance check. But so I went to the doctor the other day for just a checkup. I'm diabetic. So I went for a checkup and I was seeing a new PCP. And we were just in this conversation and she's like, I see here that you've got depression on your chart. And I've talked about this before, so I feel comfortable sharing my own medical history. But and I was like, yeah, I said, I have struggled with it in the past. I'm 2.5 years in recovery from gambling harm. And that opened up this whole great conversation with her. And I live in a state where, you know, we have 143 casinos. And so I know that she's probably seeing patients every day who are having some kind of an issue with this. And so it was really great. She asked me so many questions and just, I could tell she was really taking it in. And like, this was the first conversation that she's probably had with a patient about recovery, gambling harm specifically. Cause she was like, so when was your last bet? And she really just talked to me about how I felt, how I was feeling since then and how my recovery, you know, and I just felt really well connected. I felt real, but I have to say that I'm kind of in a privileged position that I feel like I can talk about my recovery, right? I can talk about my gambling. And this is where it gets a lot of people hung up because they're still in that anonymity mindset of like, I don't want anybody to know what I'm going through.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I'm going to be judged.
Yeah. Especially by their doctor, you know, but I'm through my work, I've just like, I talk about it so much and I talk about it with clinicians. So I guess I've gotten more comfortable in like a clinical perspective talking about it, but you know, for just somebody who's not open or maybe he hasn't even like fully accepted themselves to have that conversation with the doctor, especially medical doctor. Yeah, there's a lot of fear there. And the one thing that helps me too, is like, we're all human, right? We all deal with our own stuff and you don't know what their experience is either.
Exactly.
You know, because I've watched your TED talk and you have firsthand experience with family members in addiction, right?
Which is how I wound up doing the work that we do, you know, and 35 years ago, I was practicing in a rural area and in the area of pain management, you know, and I watched it be the try this, try that approach to meds. I mean, you even say that concept and it's like, what? You got to be kidding me. But that's the way it was being done. But then I was in a rural area. I'm like, well, now I'm in an urban area. Surely it's going to be different. It was the exact same way. And it was 20 years later. But I was seeing people move from dependency to addiction. And then personally, I married an alcoholic, a man actually who had more than just that as his addiction. And it hit home to me. A year after our daughter was born, we found out he was adopted. So he finds this out in, you know, his 30s, and that trauma to him, you know, that had just exacerbated to the behavior that he was showing, you know. So to me, it was like, wow, okay, so I'm seeing your behavior on a daily basis. Who are you today? Who are you 5 minutes from now? But now I'm bringing a child in. So I'm like, as a parent, what do I need to know? We knew nothing of health history because this was a family secret, you know, and we knew nothing. I'm like, we've got to explore, or I've got to explore what's available to learn. You know, in the genetic portion of what we do in our, what we call a biomarker evaluation report, 31 page report going over each one of these biomarkers for an individual. But when we do the genetic piece of it, the technology to look at what we do only became available in 2015. So this wasn't always around. So we're putting all of this science together to then say, more than just label something, what are we going to do about it to make changes? So it was really personal, you know, it wasn't just, it was professional, but then it became, whoa, I'm seeing this up front and close. This is real. What are you going to do?
And that changes your whole perspective, I'm sure, on everything you're looking at. You know, when it becomes like, I know professionally you can be passionate and involved, but when it becomes personal, it becomes on a whole nother level. You know, I'm a person who thought I was empathetic until I struggled with my own addiction and realized I was not as empathetic as I thought I was, you know, until I got into recovery and really started to understand this and really kind of found a passion for, you know, bringing light to this and to everybody who does work in this community, to bring back that empathy and understanding for what we're all going through. And so, yeah, I am curious though, what would you say to somebody who wants to have a conversation with their doctor, but is maybe fearful that they're going to be judged or rejected? I know we kind of touched on that a little bit ago, but I want to kind of circle back around to it to kind of help empower them.
Yeah, exactly. And where you brought in your experience, which is great, is not the average, because a physician has 10 minutes to see an individual and do the paperwork. So it's the end do the paperwork part that they don't want anything else on the paperwork. That's just reality of what they have to do in their day to get through their day. So like you said, on there will be, do you drink? How many drinks per week, right? Most of the time, they'll look at it, but not even have a conversation, because you are now opening this can of worms and you can't then have that person out the door in under 10 minutes. You can't. So from an empowering part of things, I would, if it's not on the paperwork, I'd write it down, you know, and just like you did, it opens the door for this conversation. And if nothing else, you're educating this physician on the reality of what's going on. This is not talked about. This is the reality of what's going on. And then have that mental health conversation with them, you know, and it's going to start changing things. It takes time for people to change the way they think.
Yeah.
Human nature. That's how it works. So you just keep on beating the drum. And finally it's, whoa, I hear what you're saying, you know, because it's got to be talked about. And the only way to reduce stigma or get rid of stigma is to do what you're doing, you know, openly have these conversations. Guys, this is real. Here we go today. This is real. Here we go today. And then it reduces the shame, the blame. It's like, you know what? This is a lot more common than I had any idea. And it is more common. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, nobody can advocate for us better than ourselves, right? And
correct.
Like
correct.
We know our needs. We know that we need to fix something or do something. And the only way that we can advocate for those needs is to talk about it and to explore right. And be curious and have those hard conversations. And so,
right.
You know, that's always kind of something I try and help people navigate, is how to advocate for yourself. Because I know when I first entered addiction, I knew nothing about addiction. I didn't know that something that was fun could be so harmful, that could have ruined, you know, 15 years of my life, or taken, you know, all that time and money and those things and change my behaviors and like all these different things. So when you're first coming into recovery and you're coming into that, you know, you're in survival mode at this point. At least I was.
Absolutely.
I can speak for myself.
Absolutely.
I was in absolute survival mode. I was living in chaos. And now I had to figure out what's wrong with me or how I can get help. And that can be really, really overwhelming. And so, you know, having these conversations and resources available can hopefully help other people navigate and advocate for themselves in an easier way, which is the whole point of doing this. And I want to talk more about like how you offer, what you offer to people who are trying to understand this addiction for themselves, even because I have clinicians that listen to this as well. So to find more information about what you do.
But I'll share first, it could be, this is really impactful for people. When we are going over someone's report, if they have their spouse there or a loved one or other family members, first off, from the individual, who is the person that came to us, there's oftentimes tears, but they're tears of joy because they say, you have just said exactly how I've always felt just by looking at their physiology. That is like an exhale of, and people actually use the word crazy. I'm not crazy. No, this is what your physiology is going to, what we call clinical correlations. This is going to correlate to this kind of behavior. We change that, your world changes. But for the person listening, all of a sudden there's like, whoa, that's exactly who you are. You mean there's reasons? So you're not just acting out this way. You're just not trying to, you know, turn our family upside down. You're not trying to whatever. And they get on board and now they operate as a team. That in itself is huge, huge. But so what we do is we work with people literally all over the world. We drop ship the lab kits to you. So it can also be done if you don't want anybody knowing what's happening. It can also be, you know, a very a low entry point into saying, I need help. Let's get started. You know, if you're not mentally ready to have broader conversations with the world, let's see where you're at first. So we drop ship those lab kits to you. We get those back 7 to 10 days on one part of it to 2 to 3 weeks on the other part. We create a biomarker evaluation report. We've already met with you. We even offer a 15-minute complimentary consultation just to have this is all new to people. So is this something that would even help me? Yes or no, or point you in a different direction. We get that information back. We go over that very lengthy. It takes a couple of hours because we're really diving into what's happening with you in your genetic weaknesses and your neurotransmitters. And then we go over the protocol that's created because we're not just going to sit here and say, well, we have identified. We want to say, what are we going to do to make changes? So that word that I used before, epigenetics, where we know that we can turn on or turn off those genes, we create a protocol looking at the biochemical pathways, going over each one of those. Where do we need to support? To what level do we need support? And then we create that. And either we give that to you and say, here's what to do over the next 6 months. There's 4 phases. Have at it. Or here's what you need to do. 6 months. You want to go through it with us. We will do that with you too. Someone seeing a therapist, a coach, a clinician, stay with that. You've got to do the talk therapy. As we said earlier, we're looking at the physiological piece. It's going to make the talk therapy better and easier because now you're receiving that information in a very different way. Those blocks aren't there anymore. You're hearing it. The outcomes are going to be better from that. So, you know, if it's any question of anyone of where they're at, at least do a conversation with us. And if it's, we're not the place, we'll tell you, hey, this is probably what's going on. Take a look at this. But you have to make that initial step to change or else it's never going to change. You know, the definition of insanity, right? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And you had mentioned the care piece before. It's even that self-care part of things of, you know, I'll say to people, if what goes on in your head 24 hours a day, the way you beat yourself up, if you talk to your best friend that way, how long would they be your best friend? They'd be out of there, right? Because we're so hard on ourselves. So if the first step is identifying, hey, there is reasons for all of the way my behavior is and they can be changed, life becomes different. I mean, at the end of it, our life is supposed to be a gift. You know, to get to start living it as if it is a game changer.
Absolutely. And I think adding another resource for somebody who's maybe struggled in the meeting department or, you know, the 12 step or, you know, it gives them another option to really try and understand what's going on with them. And it can make like recovery. I try and tell people it's not a life sentence. Don't make it a life sentence, you know, do meetings and do therapy and do these things, but they're all things that are supposed to encourage us to heal, get better, and look at, you know, build more self-awareness, look at what's going on around us, and make those changes. And change is the very core of how we recover. And so adding all these different things in to help us understand so that we can change. But yeah, the willingness to change has got to be the main thing. Like, that's the foundation of it all. And, you know, to grow, to learn, to be curious about, you know, what's next. Because if you just focus on, well, I'm going to be in meetings for the rest of my life, like, that becomes heavy. And it's like, it's not fun. And like, meetings are great. And I know people who've been to meetings for years and years of their recovery because it's just a part of their recovery. But, you know, therapy is not meant to be lifelong. It's meant to be in stages, you know, to help you grow, to help you get through what you're going through. So it's like building all these different things, all these different tools, and use them to kind of help change and mold a recovery that becomes life, not just recovery or life, like life. That's the goal of recovery. And so, I think this is going to be a huge piece to a lot of people. And
it really is. And so many people that, you know, they even went to rehab 3, 4, 5, 6 times because their physiology was never addressed. You can sit in rehab, sit in therapy and know the tools, and you can get 100 on your test. But until you get back out into that environment that you live in, it's different. And if we don't change the physiology, we're always going to go back to that set point, right? Yeah. And like you said, it's not meant to be forever. Either is the work that we do, addressing your physiology. There's a reason we do 6 months, because we're giving your body what it needs to support these biochemical pathways. Your body starts to learn how to use what it needed, and now it's operating correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to put all your information in the show notes, but how can people reach out and get more information?
Sure. So go to Wired for Addiction, all spelled out, wiredforaddiction.com. On there, you'll see an area for a 15-minute complimentary consultation. We started out in the justice system, and judges love seeing our reports because they, for the first time, have objective information, not subjective. He said, she said, this happened, that happened. They're like, whoa, okay, I see this. This is great. We even work with people that are in prison. So go to the website, Wired for Addiction, get a consultation, and start the conversation. And then, you know, if this is something that's going to benefit you, by all means, let's start that process. Let's get it going, because nothing's going to change if you don't do what you need to do to make the changes.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time, for your information, and for the work that you're doing. Sure. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for these kind of conversations. This is what's going to get it going, which we need.
Yeah, that's my hope.
Yep.
Okay.